What is a commonsensical view of faith and rationality? Was presented by Jack Crabtree on August 12, 2003 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Postmodernism, Reason, and the Church. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
I want to raise the issue today of the relationship between faith and rationality. And so I'm going to explore what I consider to be a commonsensical view of faith and rationality, because I think that is the biblical view. There are classic problems that we could face, and let me just mention them. These are all questions that you've asked or you've seen people ask these questions. Is human reason a reliable guide to truth? Particularly, and especially, is it a reliable guide to ultimate truth? Truth about God, spirituality, eternity, and that sort of thing. Oftentimes people will make a distinction, and in fact I suspect that that's what's going on in postmodernism, by the way. I don't think the postmodernists are thinking of their theory in the context of everyday, ordinary, mundane experience. They're thinking of their views of rationality and language and so on are primarily political language, political events, political efforts, that is the level at which they're most interested. The way the power politics and the way language and rationality plays into that. At the level of, do I see a podium here? I think they'd probably just throw up their hands and go, well, yeah, as much as we would. I mean, they would just sort of fall back like Hume does. They would, like Hume in a backgammon game, they would just fall back on plain old ordinary common sense, I think. So people often make a distinction between the rationality that we use in ordinary, mundane experience on the one hand and the relationship between rationality and the big issues, God, truth, ultimate truth, and so on. So when it comes to the big issues, is human reason a reliable guide? Another question that often gets thrown back and forth between Christians, at the fall of mankind, did human reason fall? Is my rationality now not what it was intended to be? Has sin affected my rationality such that I cannot reason any longer? Is my noetic equipment broken by sin? That's a huge question that the Christians face into. Is human reason therefore incapable now, after the fall, of leading us to truth and God now that we have fallen into sin? What's the relationship between faith and reason? Huge, huge question. Is faith rational? Is faith irrational? Is faith supra-rational? Is it non-rational? Is it extra-rational? I mean, what exactly is the relationship between my reason and this thing that we call faith? What is the role of reason in knowing God in particular? That's a huge, huge topic in modern philosophy of religion circles. Okay, all those questions we could look at different ramifications of those, but it seems to me that all of those questions, we can't really make any progress or any headway in answering them until we become clear on what we mean by reason, until we've defined rationality. Because usually in the debates, people talk past each other because what I mean by reason is not what you mean by reason, and what you mean by reason is not what I mean by reason, and so we're just talking past each other. So it becomes critical that we become clear on what we mean. There are various inadequate proposals about what rationality is. The first is, and this is very common, especially among people who criticize the role of reason in faith, is that reason is what Aristotle identified. And so they basically equate reason with Aristotelian logic. Now, if you haven't read Aristotle, that's okay. Basically, what Aristotle did is he explored a certain formal system of deductive logic. It's called the syllogism, and you may have heard of a syllogism. Aristotle just explored at length the nature and character of the syllogism. Well, all you have to do is stop for half a second and look at the way your mind works, and you realize, do we sometimes think syllogistically? Yes, we do. Does that exhaust the whole range of my rational capabilities, even logic? It's not even all of logic, let alone all of human rationality. So to reduce rationality to Aristotelian logic is obviously wrong. That's obviously false. You'll oftentimes hear people accuse fundamentalism, evangelicalism, conservative Christians as having reduced rationality to Aristotelian logic, or that they believe that our faith has to be defended by Aristotelian logic or something like that. Well, I don't know any real Christian who's ever claimed that, at least, and knowing what they're talking about. Yes, a person like me believes that faith needs to be rational, but I don't believe for a second that you can reduce it to a syllogism. A syllogism is a very, very narrow way of entering into argumentation. It's even a very narrow way of defining deduction. So, and it's very contrived. Nobody thinks that we have to use our reasoning in such a contrived and narrow way. Before we're done, I want to really broaden our concept of what rationality is. Syllogism is just, the classic syllogism is, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. You have a major premise, minor premise, and from the major premise and minor premise, you draw your conclusion. Well, it is true that in the Middle Ages, they tried to make all of their arguments fit that form, and they got really, really funky and really, really awkward and really complicated, because you're trying to take your ordinary rationality and stuff it in to a particular form to stay true to that form, when it would just be a lot easier to just think. You know, just think about this for a second and come to your conclusion. Don't worry about putting it in the right form. So no one wants to seriously suggest that our reasoning has to be controlled by such an arbitrary contrivance as Aristotelian logic. Another common mistake, I think, is to mistake rationality and human reasoning with, I'm not sure how to rightly pronounce this word. I pronounce it ratiocination. There's a difference between human reasoning and rationality and the reasoning that actual people do. And that's what I mean by ratiocination. When I sit down and I go, I think this is true, and I think this is true, and this follows from that, and then this follows from that, therefore this, I'm entering into a process of ratiocination. I'm spelling out for myself, what are my premises, what am I deducing from what, or what am I inferring from what, and from that I'm getting where? I'm getting to some conclusion. And actually being able to spell that out is ratiocination. Okay. Most of us don't think that way. Most of us are far more intuitive. We sit down, we reflect on the problem, a few ideas come to mind, and we come to our conclusions. Have we not been rational? Or for that matter, I meet somebody for the first time and the alarm bells go off. I don't think I can trust that dude. Are we being irrational? Some people would argue the only person who's being rational is the guy who goes away and takes a sheet of paper and on one side says reasons why you think you can trust this guy, reasons why you think you can't trust that guy, and you spell them out and you prove to yourself through some kind of formal chain of reasoning, I find this person untrustworthy. I have proven to myself that this person is untrustworthy. And we're accustomed to thinking that is rational to do that. To make this snap judgment as an intuition, that is not rational. I argue that's not true. I think that's a very, very misleading and misguided way to think about what our rationality is. I would argue that my definition of human reason or rationality is all that is included and all that is involved in human beings coming to understand and interact with their environment and their experience in accord with the way God created them to come to understand it. That's human reason. Okay. Human reason is everything that is included in coming to understand reality in the way God created me to come to understand reality. I mean, rationality is the equipment God gave me to come to understanding. And if we want to know what does that include, then that's an empirical question. We need to stop and watch ourselves understand reality. And if something is indeed a part of what it means to understand reality, then that's a part of rationality. Because it's a part of what God created in me to come to make contact with the world outside of me. So what does that include? I think that includes intuition. Charlie mentioned yesterday Michael Pollan's book, Personal Knowledge. That was a very influential book for me. It was very helpful to me. Because one of the things it did is lead me to these conclusions that I'm sharing with you now, a much, much broader concept of rationality than I had before. Much of what we know is what Polanyi calls tacit or inarticulate knowledge. Much of what we know is at the level that we ourselves could never articulate to ourselves. He uses the example, you see a 10-year-old boy riding his bicycle down the street. If you ask the question, does he know how to ride a bicycle? Well, apparently. But if you ask him to come in here, could you go over with me, my friend, the formulas of angular momentum that allow you to stay upright and not fall over? He couldn't do that. He couldn't articulate to you the physics of what it is he's doing, but does he know the physics of what he's doing? Absolutely. And he can prove that he knows it by his performing the task of staying upright on the bicycle and not falling over. So he doesn't have articulate knowledge of what he's doing, but he does have tacit knowledge of what he's doing. If you have the patience for it, it's not necessarily an easy book to read, but if you have the patience for it, I highly recommend that book as being kind of a book that expands your definition of what rational is. Because, I would argue, why did that boy learn how to ride the bicycle? Because he's a rational being who learned through experience, who taught himself through experience, through the reasoning that God gave him, to understand reality enough to be able to work with the laws of physics and keep that bicycle upright. So, in the example I gave earlier, when I come to a snap judgment about somebody, I cannot trust that person, is that irrational? Well, I would argue, no, it's not irrational. It may not be right. None of our rationality is infallible. We can make mistakes. We can come to wrong conclusions. But however much I may come to a wrong conclusion, I have not been irrational in my judgment. What I have done is I have collected all kinds of information, messages through body language, through spoken language, any number of clues I've picked up from my interaction with them, and I have drawn a conclusion based on that evidence. I have inferred some things about the person based on the evidence that I've collected. That's a purely rational act, a rational method that I have used. What fakes us out is that we are so accustomed to thinking that reason needs to be conscious, it needs to be methodical, it needs to be step by step spelled out and articulated in order for it to be reason, rationality. And I think that's a huge mistake. We have a whole part of our rationality that works at super speed, unconsciously, and it cranks away processing the information that we've got below the surface of consciousness where we're not even aware that we're doing it, and it just spits out a conclusion. And that's what we call an intuition. any of you who have struggled with a math problem or a physics problem or an engineering problem or something, I mean, you know that you go to sleep at night and the next morning you get up and you're drinking your orange juice and boing, all of a sudden, I know how to solve that problem. Well, you hadn't even been thinking about the problem consciously. You had been earlier, but you'd laid it to rest. You'd laid it aside. And then all of a sudden, in your head pops a potential solution or a strategy for finding a solution. Well, is that divine inspiration? Is that the Holy Spirit telling you the answer? I don't think so. In spirituality, that's often the mistake we make. We attribute as to spirituality and to God what actually is a very normal human rational process. That there's this stuff going on subterranean underneath the level of consciousness that is my rationality at work, going to work on all the clues available to me and then just giving me the conclusion. Now, the problem with intuitions, of course, is that intuitions cannot be checked, because by their very nature, they haven't given me the reason for the conclusion, the reasoning behind the conclusion. They're only giving me the conclusion. We call it a hunch. They only give me the conclusion. So one of the things that we need to discipline ourselves to do at times is, once we've got the hunch, then we go, okay, I've got what I think is the answer. Let me see if I can slow my reasoning down and spell out the steps that led to that answer, because I want to check it out. I want to see if it's sound rather than unsound. Because there are many inputs into the process, some of which can lead me astray, can be misleading, can be false. And so we learn through experience when we can trust our hunches and when we can't trust our hunches. And even then, that's not infallible, but we learn from experience when we're likely to have correct hunches and when we're more likely to have incorrect hunches. But my basic point is, that is an aspect of human reason, human rationality, I think. Perception and all that perception entails or involves is part of rationality. We don't typically think of it as part of rationality, but notice that that's where Reed spends most of his time. What's going on when we do something as simple as open our eyes and see a tree? What's going on? Well, my reason is at work. My reason is making judgments about the outside world there that we typically call just seeing something or perceiving something or sensing something. Well, that's an eminently complicated rational process in and of itself. One of the mistakes that philosophers have made, and this is where postmodernism has identified something I think really profoundly true, is there's no such thing as looking out the tree, opening your eye, looking out the window, opening your eyes and seeing a tree. That's not a simple process. That involves all kinds of assumptions, all kinds of judgments, all kinds of preconceptions that are at play. I'm constructing that perception. That's not just happening to me, I'm constructing that. And I think they're right about that, not wrong about that. So perception is a rational process that involves rational decisions and rational judgments and rational construction of reality. The imagination is eminently rational. It's not non-rational or irrational. It's a part of rationality. Doubt is part of rationality. It's the self-correcting, self-critical aspect of reality, and it needs to be that way. We make mistakes, so to be able to identify when we've made a mistake and adjust our beliefs in order to correct them, that's a part of rational processes. The intrinsic significance or the intrinsic meaning of emotions and feelings is part of our rationality. It's not non-rational. That's part of rationality. To have fear, to signal that I am afraid of something in my experience, in reality, is a sign, a signal that I should pay attention to, that my reason pays attention to, that leads me to certain knowledge, understanding, a judgment about the world. Language, all of our language and all the aspects of language and how we use it, that's a part of rationality. So my bottom line point here is we need to be clear when we ask the question, like, what's the relationship between faith and reason, that we don't have such a narrow and contrived conception of reason that there's no way that faith can be simply rational. I mean, if you eliminate things like imagination and doubt and perception and intuition and say, obviously, doubt, imagination, intuition play a huge role in faith. So faith is obviously non-rational if you define rational so narrowly that it excludes those things. But why would we define rationality so narrowly? That's my question. And my answer to that is we need to have such a broad and all-inclusive and all-encompassing concept of rationality that we don't artificially eliminate all that stuff that God put there, that belongs there. Now, reason ultimately does not specify how we come to true beliefs. Rather, it specifies a standard of logic and intelligent judgment by which we ultimately judge the worth of that belief, whether or not it's worthy of our consent. There are other things that enter into why or how we come to the beliefs. And some of those things are, as I've said, misleading to us. My desires, my passions, interests, values that I have can all influence me toward a certain set of beliefs rather than another set of belief, or this belief rather than that belief. Rationality, reason, comes along and sets a standard and says, okay, never mind how you came to that belief and why you came to hold that belief. Is that belief worthy of your assent? And reason is establishing the standard for judging that. And I think it's the God-given standard for doing so. One of the mistakes in the history of philosophy that is with us today, and it's huge, it goes all the way back to Plato. It thrived in the Middle Ages. It was the basis for the Enlightenment, and we've never really shaken it off. And that is that the standard of worthiness of assent is certainty. Any belief that is worthy of my embracing it is a belief that is some belief that is certain to me. Now again, it's a crazy standard, because all we have to do is stop and watch our own lives and realize I don't know nothing then. If I have to be certain in order to be warranted in believing something, what am I warranted in believing? And yet, in our everyday life, when we're not doing philosophy, we know all kinds of things. I know that my car is parked out there and probably has a ticket. I know this, I know that. I know all kinds of stuff. But if some skeptic were to come along and say, well, how do you know that, Jack? Are you sure of that? Is it logically impossible that it's otherwise? Isn't it logically possible that such and such is the case instead? Because we have established certainty as the criteria, and then we've construed the nature of that certainty as a kind of logical certainty, there's almost no beliefs in the world that can stand, that can match that standard. And by that standard, then we should reject all of our beliefs. So we have a choice. We can either reject all of our beliefs, or we can say, that's a pretty funky standard. That doesn't make any sense. I read an article by an Oxford professor who argued that we all know, he just took this for granted, we all know that faith, by its very nature, means having certain knowledge. Knowing something with certainty. That he just inherited that from the Middle Ages. We know that a knowledge of God, for example, is going to be a knowledge that is certain, involves certainty. Christianity is based on historical knowledge, what Jesus did, what he said, what people said he said, the miracle claims about Jesus and so on. We all know that historical knowledge is not certain knowledge, but is only what he calls probable knowledge. Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't happen. Depends on how what kind of a gambler you are. But maybe it happened. But it certainly does not arise to the level of certainty. Therefore, Christianity is an inadequate basis for claiming to know God. There is no foundation for faith in the Christian message. And, you know, I think he thinks that he was being really clever there by establishing the impossibility of Christianity being the ground for a knowledge of God. Well, the problem I have with that is his first premise. Whoever said that faith has to involve certainty? The apostles never say that. I mean, I think if you were to go to the Apostle Paul and say, is it logically possible that Jesus didn't rise from the dead and that instead his body was lifted off the cross by Martians, for example, or whatever? I mean, come up with some other logical possibility. Is that not logically possible? I think Paul would have fully acknowledged, well, yeah, it's logically possible. But that didn't happen. Well, the skeptic would say, well, since it's logically possible that it happened another way, how do you know that? And what they mean by how do you know that is, how can you possibly be warranted in believing what you believe when there are other logical possibilities? Well, apply that standard to all your other knowledge in life. And it's just completely unrealistic. It's just completely non-commonsensical. All kinds of stuff I know that if some skeptic were to play the skeptic's game on me, then I'd no longer be warranted in claiming to know it. Well, the apostles are never claiming that our knowledge of the history of Jesus, the historical claims of the gospel and so on, rise to any level of certainty beyond anything else that we know. It's the same level of certainty. It either happened or it didn't happen, and you either know that it happened or didn't know it happened the same way you know anything else that you know happened or didn't happen. Is there room for doubt? Well, yeah. Okay. There's always room for doubt if you want to. I mean, in fact, doubt is something that you can create experience at demand if you want to. We can spend the next 30 seconds doubting if you want to. I mean, it's just an experience that you can have. Does it mean anything? Maybe, maybe not. It depends. So the fact that there's a logical possibility that all of this stuff is a dream, it's all made up, it's all invented, okay, yeah, all that's logically possible. Do I believe that that's the way it went down? No. I think Jesus really existed. I think he really did raise from the dead. I think he really was the Son of God. Do you know that? Sure, I know that. Could you be wrong? Could be. So, but how does a knower know what they know? And by the same standards that I apply to everything else in my life, I know that Jesus was the Son of God and raised from the dead the same way I know Australia exists. It's logically possible Australia doesn't exist. You know, that plane that was alleged to be traveling to Sydney, it's all a hoax. Australia is just this huge... I mean, think about it for a second. Is it plausible that Australia exists? Duckbill platypus. Right. Kangaroo. Wallabies. Come on, give me a break. I mean, the skeptic can turn any of this stuff around on you. It doesn't matter because the standard is common sense. We know how we know what we know, and when we know things the way we know things, we're warranted in knowing things. We don't need any greater warrant than that. Okay, so I have a thesis here with respect to the relationship between faith and reason based on that, understanding that when I mean reason in a fairly broad sense that includes a lot of different things. The first part of my thesis is that reason is the one and only way that a human being can come to know anything that can be known. Reason and reason alone is how we know what we know. And that's just as true of God and ultimate truth as it is of ordinary, everyday, mundane matters. So there is no extra rational path to authentic knowledge. And that means that faith is not a way of knowing that is distinct or different from reason and rational processes. Now, I realize that that's controversial. I don't know if that's controversial in this room, but within Christian culture in general, that's a highly controversial claim, because I think your typical Christian sees faith as something different than and other than rationality. It may somehow be grounded in rationality and be boosted along by rationality. It may have some relationship with rationality, but it goes above and beyond rationality and allows me to know things that I couldn't otherwise know by reason alone. And that, I think that's a more typical view in Christian culture. I repudiate that. I don't think that's right. Reason is the God-given means by which God intended knowers to know what they know, and that's the only equipment he's given us, the only method there is, the only route to understanding. And by the same token, therefore, reason is adequate. This is the second part of my thesis. Reason is adequate to the task of knowing God and ultimate truth sufficiently. So when our doctrine goes beyond rationality, we need to be careful. Once my doctrine goes beyond rationality, how do I know the difference between truth and nonsense? Because the standard that God gave me to judge my knowledge with is rationality. Once it transgresses that standard, there's no difference between superior truth and just flat-out contradiction and nonsense. It all is the same thing. How will I know the difference?
Can you give an example of where someone could say that it's an extra rational truth?
Well, okay, this is a little trickier, because I don't know what I think about this, but take the notion that is very common that God exists outside of time. God is a non-temporal being and he exists outside of time. That actually may be true. But let me tell you why I have a problem with that and why I pause at that. Is because I don't even know what that would mean. What do we mean God is outside of time? The people who try to explain what that means always resort to an analogy, usually geometry. They drop timeline, they call that time. Well, now I can get outside of time. God's up here. Okay, what does that mean? He has direct access to every time, every point on the timeline at the same time, which is immediately where we get into problem. What does it mean for God to be outside of time? I've never been outside of time. I've never been able to even imagine being outside of time. In fact, in the very process of using my imagination to imagine being out of time, I'm enduring through time. I have no idea what that's supposed to mean. And so at that point, I would be at least agnostic, and I certainly wouldn't take a confident doctrinal stand, God is outside of time, and then argue from that. And then go on to use that as a point that I argue with and from about other issues. I don't know. So, I would argue that mysticism is a huge mistake. Mysticism is a way of abandoning rationality within the context of our faith. It's a claim that there's a way of having contact with a reality that's like knowledge or knowledge-like without using reason. There's no justification for non-rational or irrational beliefs in the context of the Christian faith, I would argue. Now, let me be clear about that. The standard is rationality, not my experience or my perspective. Does the Bible teach us that God is unfathomable? Unfathomable? Does the Bible teach us that? Yes. Why? Because he's above reason? No, not because he's above reason, but because he's above me. He's so much bigger, greater, more powerful, wiser, more experienced, exists on a different level, experiences reality, relates to reality from a different perspective than I do. And perspective is huge. Perspective is important. I can't understand what it's like to relate to reality from God's perspective without being God. So sure, I can't relate to God in that sense, and much of what God does, much of what he's about, is going to be, to a certain extent, unfathomable to me. I think that's what the prophet means, his ways are above my ways. But we use that text, his ways are above my ways, not to say he has a radically different perspective from mine, but to say, see, he doesn't have to be rational. And irrationality is okay because his ways are above my ways. That's not what it says. I don't think he violates rationality. He is the source of rationality. He is reason itself, having made a world that is rational in accordance with his rationality. He doesn't violate rationality, but he's not me. I'm limited and finite, and he's not. So of course I won't understand God in depth to the fullness, exhaustively. but that we can't use that as a justification for my beliefs being non-rational or irrational. Okay? Now I want to, in order to answer those questions that I posed at the first, I think it's crucial that we recognize that there are two aspects of human rationality. And let me borrow an analogy from the computer world, and maybe this is misleading, maybe this is dangerous, but at this point in time, at least it works for me. I think we need to make a distinction between the ROM of human rationality. Before you turn the switch on a computer, the computer is just a really, really dumb, stupid piece of machinery sitting there on the desk. You turn the switch on, and it learns really fast. It teaches itself a whole bunch of stuff. It teaches itself what it means when you push that key on the keyboard. It teaches itself how to make calculations. There's all kinds of stuff that it immediately teaches itself. Well, how does it teach itself that? Because when you turn the switch on and it boots up the system, booting up the system is basically taking the knowledge that is hardwired into the circuitry of the circuit board and putting that in its memory, in its mind, if you will. So it has become smart now when it booted all that stuff up. Well, those circuit boards contain what they call the ROM of a computer, the read-only memory. You can't change it. You can't alter it. Anything you do on the keyboard, any programming you do, can't change that part of what the computer knows, because it's not software, it's hardware. It's not something that's just written onto the memory. It's actually built into the engineering of the circuit board itself. The circuit board is a language that teaches the computer to be a computer. RAM, the random access memory, is the memory that we can play with. We can put this data on it, we can erase it and put other data on it, we can take that data and move it somewhere else and manipulate it. That's the other part of the memory, the part that we're aware of, that we use all the time when we use a computer. Well, that's malleable. That can be changed. That can be shaped. And it's built on and based on the computer being able to operate out of its ROM. That's what makes the other even possible. I would argue that the human mind, at least by analogy, has two aspects to it as well. There's the ROM, which Reed calls common sense, stuff that is just hardwired into a human being, if you will, and obviously I'm using that metaphorically, but hardwired into a human being, it just is a given. It's what makes an intelligent human being an intelligent human being. We have the intelligence we do because we have hardwired into us certain basic assumptions about the world and certain basic abilities to do reasoning. Deductive reasoning, inductive reasoning. We make inferences, and we know how to make inferences. We know how to make inferences whether we like it or not. The infant lying in the crib knows how to make inferences without even knowing that it knows how to make inferences. It knows how to make inferences. That's the ROM of human rationality. The RAM of human rationality is the knowledge that we begin to build for ourselves based on the input of our experience. We live in the world, things happen to us, we watch things, we see things, we observe things, and we begin to make inferences out of this ROM that knows how to make inferences. We begin to make inferences and we start coming to conclusions. Oh, I see. Roses smell like that. I see. Rose thorns hurt when you eat them. Stoves that glow orange, you ought not to touch normally. Things like that. I mean, we begin to draw conclusions. And then we store that in our RAM, if you will. And we get more and more advanced in our knowledge. We know how to be efficient, so sooner or later we begin to take all kinds of things for granted. I take it for granted that Australia exists. You know, every time somebody says I'm going to Australia, I don't stop. Okay, now wait a minute. How do I know Australia is a real place? what's the evidence for that? I don't have to reconstruct the whole superstructure of my knowledge from the ground up every time somebody mentions something. I learned that if I'm going to have time in this world for leisure, I'm going to have to begin to take certain things for granted. I don't remember how I know that, but I know that. So we just know all that we have, this whole mass of knowledge that we know. Those are what a philosopher would call basic beliefs. But they're not basic because they're built into the foundations, into the ROM of rationality. They're basic because they become basic for me. They become the givens for me, my presuppositions, my axioms. Now, are those right or are they wrong? Are they true or are they false? Could be either. It depends. What was the reason I came to that conclusion? Did I have good reason? Did I have good evidence? Even if I had good reason and good evidence, did I have extensive enough experience? A belief can be a rational belief and still be a false belief. It's rational in that a rational person like me ought to believe it, given the extent of the experience I've had. But the problem is, I didn't have extensive enough experience, and I didn't know that the conclusion I came to was actually false, even though I came by my mistake and my false belief honestly and rationally, if you will. So rationality doesn't guarantee truth. It just guarantees that it meets a certain standard of intellectual integrity, of intellectual responsibility. But ultimately, experience itself is going to correct me if I get things wrong. More extensive experience will lead to greater knowledge. The ROM-like aspect of human rationality, I would argue, no, it's completely unaffected by sin. The non-believer is just as capable of making inferences as I am. You know, it's not like they try to add up 2 plus 2 and they just, you know, 5, 3, 6. Dang, can't do that. And it's not like their mind doesn't work. Their mind works very, very well, just like mine does. That's unaffected by human sin. What is vulnerable to human sin, what is vulnerable to corruption, is the RAM-like aspect of our rationality. Because there's a certain kind of discretion in the RAM-like part of our rationality that involves my freedom and my choices, and therefore is vulnerable to my desires and my passions and my agenda. And if my agenda is to not bow the knee to God, then I have some flexibility to be able to construct my view of the world, my knowledge of the world, in such a way that makes sure God doesn't have any place in it. I'm free to do that. And my propensity, my allergy to God, which the Bible calls sin, therefore greatly affects what I claim to know about the world. So the RAM-like aspect of my rationality is very vulnerable to sin, even while the ROM-like aspect of my rationality is not at all vulnerable to sin. Is human rationality reliable and trustworthy? The ROM is, the RAM is not. Can human rationality attain to a knowledge of God? Well, the ROM-like aspect of human rationality is foundational to a knowledge of God. I would argue that we have all the equipment we need to look at the world, experience, and come to the conclusion that there is a creator God behind all of this. It's all there. It's all available. The RAM-like aspect of our rationality may or may not lead to a knowledge of God, however, because it depends on my moral condition, my spiritual condition. Am I willing to believe in God? Am I willing to be grateful to my Creator? If not, I can find 50 ways to avoid that conclusion. Is truth itself ever irrational? And is falsehood ever rational? Truth is never irrational by the standards of the ROM of human intelligence, the built-in rationality that God has created there. But by the assumptions of my own particular worldview and my own particular constructed rationality in the RAM-like aspects of my rationality, yeah, truth can be irrational. Because in the RAM-like aspects of my rationality, there's a lot of flexibility for me to define what I will accept as evidence, what I will call a good argument and not a good argument, what perceptions of reality I will credit as being valid and what perceptions I will dismiss as invalid. There's freedom for me to choose all that. And so you may be a believer and you come along and you say, you know, I look at the rainbow and I say, how can there not be a God? And I may with all sincerity say, I just don't get you, Christians. It's just a rainbow, man. Yeah, I don't see God. I don't believe in God just because I see a rainbow. They ought not to be in the position where they can't see God when they see a rainbow, but people do get themselves in that position because they form their own rationality. In the RAM-like aspects of their rationality, they create, shape, mold, and form their own rationality in such a way that they just don't see what I see. They don't perceive the world the same way I perceive it. That, again, is vulnerable to sin. Okay. There's two reasons why falsehood can be rational. One is rationality itself doesn't guarantee truth. It only guarantees integrity. I have come by my belief honestly, but as I said, limited experience can mislead me into to rationally believing something that is not actually true. That's one reason why falsehood can be rational. And the other reason is because in the RAM-like aspects of my rationality, I can train myself to see things that ought not to be seen and to value things that ought not to be valued and have perceptions that, and values that ought not to be there. They're not really ultimately warranted, but I have chosen them, and that has become my rationality. So you can sort of see where I'm going, and I'll stop with this and open up for your questions, but you can sort of see where I'm going here. When we ask the question of, when the postmodernist says rationality is a construct, is a social construct, you know, a Christian's knee-jerk reaction to that may very well be, well, that can't be right. God created my rationality. But when we recognize this dual aspect to our rationality, there is one aspect of our rationality that ultimately is a social-cultural construct. I don't think it's only a social-cultural construct. It's a personal construct. In fact, even maybe more basically personal than it is social-cultural. But it is a construct. We have created our own rationality. And I think there's a sense in which the postmodernists are right about that. They're not wrong about that. But the problem with postmodernism is they don't make the distinction between those two aspects of rationality. They just say reason is a construct, and they're just as ready to throw logic into that as they are other beliefs about the world. And there I think that's why most of us go, huh? That doesn't make any sense. 2 + 2 = 4. No matter who's constructed it. I mean, that's just built in. That's just given. There's no messing with that. The rules of logic, there's no messing with that. How can that be a construct? Okay, that's probably confusing enough that you have a bunch of questions, so...
I'm not sure what the question is yet, but one thing I have observed that has always been, that's been most helpful, is the distinctions that you make. Like even... yesterday, it kind of leapt out of me, this question of why would it not be a fundamental starting place for a professor of philosophy to say, we're going to talk about philosophy today and two different systems of it. This one's descriptive, this one's prescriptive. Know the difference. It will be very helpful for you. And of course, I am suspicious that there are all kinds of agendas about why not, and they're not necessarily insidious or something like that, but those distinctions are really amazingly helpful, because it seems like we're really close with something like reason in the way you've just described it. There's a lot about the model of categorizing things and experiences that Hume does that make a lot of sense. And very helpful, the way he breaks down those categories. Why do we so often make the mistake of what seems like ignoring the possibility of distinctions in rational thought? They seem pretty simple to make, and if you can see that, that does seem to be a perspective with which to approach reason that makes it much more doable and makes sense of it. It bridges a lot of gaps, whereas something like absolute certainty, there's no way to distinguish kinds of knowledge. So you're sunk. Or you achieve it. What about just the common sense of distinctions? Why does a postmodernist have to leap from the cacophony of experiences that we have to there's no way to discern them?
I wish I had an answer. I don't know. I mean, that's, Gary was asking me earlier, do I really understand postmodernism? And I had to say, not really. And one of the reasons I don't understand it is I can't get past my common sense enough to know why would one be such an enemy of ordinary rationality and ordinary common sense and our ordinary way of reasoning? Why would you be so suspicious of that? And I can't empathize with that. I really don't understand that. Until I could empathize with it, I don't really think I can get inside of it and understand it. Did you? Yeah.
Well, something you said the other day, though, seems to be part of it, and that is postmodernism is a reaction to modernism. And so what is it in modernism that bugs them? And I think it's that in a lot of modernism, it's mechanical, that rationality is mechanical. And the goal of the modernist was to make it rationality just mechanical. And so part of it would be that, you know, so part of it is just a reaction against any mechanical model of rationality, that it doesn't capture it. It's missing it. And so, I mean, as you explained the other day, that's at least would seem to be a part of why, you know, and a part of why they're right, of why they want to attack rationality the way they attack it.
The distinction in particular, why are we not more eager to make the appropriate distinctions to bring clarity? Isn't that part of your question? Any insight into that?
Because distinction is so arbitrary in modernism, perhaps. I mean, I think that in modernism, distinction went so far that it just became almost also nonsensical, and so there's a reaction to distinction itself, perhaps.
Here's the only way I can understand that. It's when you understand that I think the postmodernists are mostly interested in social political issues, that makes sense. Because when I think about ordinary life and reality, I don't think my distinctions are arbitrary. But what they're looking at is, in America, when whites were whites and blacks were blacks, and they arbitrarily decided, made a value judgment between white and black, what an evil that was. And they looked all over the world at racism, at classism, at all these ways at which distinctions were made, and then priority was given to one pole over the other in a social political context. One group became privileged over the other. And that's just evil. Now, what I don't understand is the jump from, so all distinctions in all contexts are evil. As a Christian, I can agree with their political social judgments, but language is a problem? I can't go there.
I have an example of that.
Okay.
I've been thinking about this as you were talking, that one of the things that struck me in your talk is that Polanyi and tacit knowledge and intuitive knowledge that is rational is extremely validating to me as a woman, and I see this absence of women's strengths being emphasized in modernism. And I think it's a really good example of this kind of, I think we lost a lot because women were undervalued in the system that brought us the Enlightenment, basically, and therefore they didn't really have a say or any input into this whole thing that modernism brought. And I think we lost a huge chunk of information that women's ways of knowing things could have been helpful to add. And so I really appreciate that that the way you're making the distinctions includes that as rational and doesn't see that as an inherent problem. Does that make sense? It's like that can be an answer to the problem of modernism rather than the postmodern answer, which is all distinctions are bad, and especially because modernism excludes women or whatever, it's like, yeah, that's a problem, but this answers that problem without throwing out reason.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, and you're exactly right. I mean, what the kind of stereotypical Archie Bunker comment, women are irrational, means is they're more intuitive than I am.
Exactly.
And yeah, that's exactly the point.
You talked about certain knowledge and or certainty, and I want to know what, you know, the modern perspective said that there's certain knowledge, and postmodern is there's no single truth. And but could you talk about what the moderns meant when they talk about certain knowledge? Because you were saying there's nothing certain. So what is meant by certainty?
Well,
by the modernists,
they meant logically certain, but they obviously only applied it very, very selectively. I mean, they just didn't think about it. The other day, in one of the discussions groups, I don't even know who it was, but somebody raised the issue, well, we don't really know that, which is a common way for us to speak, common circumlocution that we use. Well, I don't really know it, but, well, what do we mean by that? When we said, I don't really know it, is I couldn't really prove that to you such that it's logically certain, so that there's no other logical possibility but what this is the case. I mean, we're almost apologetic about that. We say it's really not a valid claim to knowledge if there's any room for uncertainty at all. That's coming right out of modernism. That's coming right out, well, I mean, it's coming ultimately right out of ancient Greek philosophy. But it's just this prejudice that we inherited that has never really been successfully refuted or challenged or argued with. And so it's even crept into our common vernacular at this point, that there's knowledge and there's opinion. When does your opinion elevate to the level of knowledge? When it gets to the point where it's logically impossible that your opinion is wrong. Now we can claim to know it. We say that on the one hand, but on the other hand, we live our lives, operate, and speak other times as if there's all kinds of stuff that we know. That by that same standard, we shouldn't be able to claim that we know it, but we just aren't applying that standard at that point in time. The only time we apply it is when it allows us to avoid believing things that we really don't want to believe, that reason dictates we probably should believe, like God and Christianity and stuff like that.
I agree with you what you said about the ROM not falling, basically, but I did have a couple qualifiers to add to that, because the difference wouldn't be between believers and unbelievers, it seems to me, because the fall would affect both believers and unbelievers.
Mm-hmm.
Sin would affect both.
Right.
And an example of the ROM falling or being affected by the fall, just by clarification, would be an example of mental problems,
okay,
where the ROM would come directly. The ROM would be fallen directly because of the fall.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point.
Jack, you made a comment earlier that I was scribbling to write it down. I don't think I really got it. But something to the effect of faith shouldn't be seen as something that's above reason. I'm one who's struggling to think through those issues. And like Dave, I'm not sure what the question is exactly, but how do I understand faith in regards to the idea of being given eyes to see? And if I am not given those eyes by God, then I cannot truly be rational? Or people who have not been given those eyes to see, do they not have the capacity to be truly rational? And I guess I think you tried to answer that with the ROM and the RAM, and I just wasn't understanding. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Now, let me try. Okay, yeah, at the level of my operating system, my ROM, I'm always rational. I can't help myself. I can't be otherwise. You know, even when that we're self-reflective, so we can doubt our ROM, but we can't doubt our ROM without using our ROM. So in practice, we have to assume it and validate it at the same time that philosophically I'm coming up with propositions about how inadequate and unreliable it is and it doesn't work.
Right.
But we can't ever betray it in my actions, in my actual reasoning process, because it's hardwired into me, I would argue. I would argue, now some people disagree with me, especially some people in the Calvinist tradition, would argue that it's actually within the realm, our belief in God. I would argue that our belief in God is something that we derive from experience. It's something we have evidence for. It's not something that we can know directly and innately. We have evidence for it, and so you can have proofs for it, if you will. They may be at the level of intuition, not step-by-step argued proofs that are well-crafted. It may just be an intuition. I look at the world and I go, well, where else did this come from? You know, a philosopher can begin to kind of take me apart, but my intuition is my intuition, and it's right, I think. I may not have a foolproof proof, but I have a sound rational intuition that God exists. Well, that comes because of my experience, and so I have evidence for it. Now, what if I don't want to follow the evidence? Being a rational being operating with intellectual integrity, I think Paul would say, the conclusion that you would have to come to is that God exists. The problem is we don't have to operate with intellectual integrity. We can decide to be intellectually dishonest at any point we want to. And when we are able and willing to become intellectually dishonest, we don't follow the evidence where it leads, we go somewhere else instead. Now, if you want to call that being irrational, then I would say, then that, right, sin makes me irrational at that point. And so God giving me eyes to see and ears to hear is not giving me knowledge that I couldn't otherwise have. It's giving me honesty that I wouldn't otherwise have, the courage to follow the evidence, the integrity to follow the evidence, the humility to follow the evidence. It's really a spiritual quality that he imbues in me, not an extra rational quality.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
No, the distinction of giving you the honesty is helpful. Okay.
That's what I was trying to say yesterday in answer to your question. Is that, I know you're still wrestling with it. Does that?
I'm still wrestling.
Huh?
I'm still wrestling.
Okay.
Yeah. At what point do you chalk things up to mystery? To something that you've gone through the experience, you've tried to rationalize, and you get to the point where you're like, I guess I'm not supposed to know this, or maybe this was never meant for me to know, or something along those lines.
It seems to me that the human mind is capable of knowing when it's reached its own limits. That's the mistake a lot of people make, is that they call nonsense and contradiction mystery, glorify nonsense and contradiction. If something is a mystery, I ought to be able to put my finger on why it's a mystery to me. So, for example, if I can realize the reason I cannot know that is because I'm not God, okay, now I know why I don't know that. Now I know why that's unfathomable to me. Now I know why that's mysterious to me, because in order to know that, I would have to not be me, I'd have to be God. Well, I've recognized why my reason is limited in being able to take me any further in knowledge. So when I come to the edge of the boundaries of my knowledge and peer into the darkness beyond and know that I'm trying to peer into the darkness beyond, I know that the answer to whatever question I'm pondering would be mysterious to me because I can't go there. I can't be other than what I am. I can't be other than bounded in the way that I'm bounded. So then I think to call something a mystery is perfectly warranted. That makes sense.
Are there any other, you said that I wouldn't be able to know because I'm not God. Is there any other type of, is there any other way to stop? Is there only other place? Because that seems like...
When I realize I have, my experience is too limited.
Okay.
I don't have enough experience, I don't have enough evidence, I don't have enough input, I don't have enough breadth of experience to be able to come to a rational conclusion about this. So that's not so much mystery as it is a reason to be agnostic. you know, we have an experience, and we don't know what to make of the experience. Why don't you know what to make of the experience? Well, I don't know why I don't know. I don't know why I don't know how to make sense of the experience. I have not enough experience to be able to know what I'm lacking here. But I know that I know that I would need more input. I need more information. I need more data to be able to make a coherent picture out of this thing that I've experienced or whatever. So again, it's a different boundary, but I'm up against the boundaries of I'm a finite person who hasn't had unlimited experience, and I need more experience to be able to draw a conclusion.
Do you have an example for that type of answer?
Well, for example, every now and then, if you talk to someone who's experiencing incredible emotional problems of some kind because of things that have happened in their life, you know, they've been abused, they've been treated in a way that I was not treated, so I have no experience comparable to the experience they've gone to. Since I've had no experience comparable to the experience that they've gone through, I don't know what the likely effects of that experience are on a person, and I've never experienced those effects. So oftentimes you talk to people who describe their problems and their struggles and their fears and their anxieties, and you just can't relate to them. You don't know what it's like to be them. And they do the best they can to explain that to you, but you come to a certain point where you're limited. You can go so far, your imagination will take you a certain distance, but there comes a point where you're up against a boundary. I can't fully empathize. I can't fully understand what you're talking about.
I'm sorry, Jack. Okay, as you're talking, I'm thinking, and Christ's words to Thomas come to my mind when he says, you know, blessed are the eyes who don't see and yet believe, and I don't know exactly quite how he finishes that line.
Mm-hmm.
What is Jesus addressing there if it... I mean, we know Thomas was saying that he wasn't going to believe if he didn't touch Christ and put his hand aside, and yada yada. What was Jesus addressing in Thomas, or what do you think Jesus was addressing in Thomas? And does this have anything to do with what we're talking about? It seems.
Yes and no.
Okay.
Yes and no. I think what Jesus is acknowledging is a very commonsensical kind of thing, and that is, there is a built-in problem with eyewitness testimony. And the problem with eyewitness testimony is that we have learned through experience it can sometimes be exaggerated, it can sometimes be fraudulent. I mean, that there are various eyewitness testimony gets me in touch with the historical reality, but it's mediated through the eyewitness testimony, and there's all kinds of room there for being misled and deceived. So Thomas was asking that he could himself be an eyewitness of the resurrected Jesus. And Jesus granted that, acknowledged the legitimacy of that and the validity of that, and offered that to him and gave that to him. Thomas, in response to it, when he was an eyewitness to it, said, "My Lord and my God." And then Jesus responds saying, you know, "Blessed are you because you believe." How's he put it?
Let's see. Or something to the effect of,
blessed are those who believe and don't see. Yeah, blessed are those who believe and yet they don't see. Well, okay, sometimes people take that to mean, they take the blessed as if it's some kind of statement of virtue. Boy, those are really hot spiritual dudes who believe anyway, even though they don't have the... I don't think that's what he's saying at all. He's saying fortunate, lucky, indeed, having been blessed by God, are those who, against the obstacle that's going to be created here very shortly between them and the historical reality of me and my resurrection, my death, and so on, I realize there's a built-in problem for them. They're not here to see it themselves, and they're going to have to rely upon the testimony of other people. That's an obstacle that sin is going to use to rationalize like crazy. And we see that all the time. I mean, how many people do you know dismiss it because, they just made that up. They're just telling you stories. Against that obstacle, some of us have come to believe anyway.
Yeah.
Now, did we believe because we just arbitrarily decided, I want to be a Christian? No. We came to it rationally. I don't have eyewitness testimony of the historicity of all this stuff. I do. I'm not directly an eyewitness. I do have the eyewitness testimony that I can look at, and that's a piece of evidence. That's not unimportant. That's important to me. But there are other factors that go into me understanding the rationality of the Christian faith and the claims. Things like how much sense these apostles make out of my own personal experience that I do have direct contact with. They call me a sinner. I look at my life. That rings true. That makes sense. I mean, and I can't even enumerate all the things that have gone in to my reason deciding and making the judgment Christianity is true, but they're on several different fronts. There are innumerable aspects to what has led me to rationally conclude, this ain't no religion, this is the truth. So that's not an, that Jesus isn't saying, blessed are the people who are irrational right. in embracing Christianity. It's blessed are the people who are able by rational means to overcome this huge obstacle mm-hmm. that's going to be inherent in their situation.
Yeah, I have a question pertaining to more the God's work of grace and how you see that factoring into rationality. I'm of the opinion the Bible teaches that even human rationality is corrupted by sin, and that God's redeeming work of grace in our life is able to save us.
You mean what I'm calling the wrong? Even the wrong is corrupted?
I guess so, yeah. Okay. So I'm just wondering how you see God's work of grace in someone's life factoring into this process of rationality towards salvation.
Okay. God could have... I mean, I've already stated where I think the point of transformation is. It's at the point of my moral and spiritual character, bringing me to have the courage and the humility to be honest with the evidence rather than try to avoid and escape the evidence. So I think that's the point at which the grace of God works. Why is that grace at which he's working? I think God could have left every human being on the planet wallowing in their own rebellion. He could have. God has determined instead that some will be saved. And to those who he has chosen to be saved, he grants the grace to open their eyes that they can see, is the metaphor, soften their heart, you know, whatever the metaphor is. But I think what all those metaphors are getting at is in sanctifying us, in leading us to repentance, he's bringing us to the moral and spiritual condition where instead of running away from God, we are willing to step toward him and bow before him. Instead of being ungrateful and bitchy toward God, he turns our hearts to be grateful toward God and submissive to him, to subject ourselves to his mastery over us. That's not a rational or intellectual problem fundamentally. It's a moral spiritual problem, but it has a huge impact on what we do with our reason. So it's understandable that we experience it as having my very rationality itself renewed. But we were fully capable of doing belief in God rationally before the grace of God, just as much as we were after the grace of God, in terms of our intellectual capabilities. Our rational capabilities were already there. That's why we're accountable. That's why God can, in my darkness, blame me for being in darkness, because the reason I'm in darkness is because I have chosen so, not because I am constitutionally incapable of seeing God and knowing God, but because I have chosen to not go know God. What he does in his grace is he takes someone who refuses to know God and changes him or her into one who wants to know God. And now my mind is free from my bondage to my rebellion, is now free to follow the evidence and follow where reason leads, which must necessarily lead to God. Does that make sense? Okay. Go ahead.
Hebrews 11, chapter the first verse, which is often used about, I've heard that, you know, said, so don't you doubt, because faith is the assurance of things hoped for and not seen, and this and that. And then sometimes they'll pull in the term a leap of faith when you get to the point of where your reason can't help you anymore. Can you speak to what Paul is saying about having that assurance, and is, you know, I'm guessing that you'll say that is rational. Show me how that kind of faith is rational.
Well, unfortunately, I think that's a very, very tragic mistranslation. 11.1 is. I would translate it, see if I can remember. Faith is the word that's used there, hypostasis, is a word that in the papyri is used if you own a house, the title deed, the paper document that you have that is the foundation for your ownership of the house is called the hypostasis, which is the word that he uses there. So as a metaphor, you might translate it something like the title deed of, let's see, how's it usually translated? Faith is the
assurance
of things not seen, right? Okay. It's the title deed of things not seen. And what I think he's getting at is, take something like my forgiveness in the eyes of God, my justification in the eyes of God. That's not a tangible, visible reality. It's buried, secreted up in the mind of God. How do I know it's true? How do I know that I'm justified in God's eyes? Well, I think Paul's perspective is, my getting the gospel preached at me and my being responsive, positively responsive to it, in other words, what he calls faith, that's how I know that I'm one of those people that God has chosen to grant forgiveness to grant mercy to. That's the brand of his ownership. That's the brand of his purposes and intentions on my life. Is my being a believer is the indicator that I have been chosen to be a child of God, destined to inherit the kingdom of God. So that's why faith is the title deed on these things that otherwise would be not unseen and unseeable to us for the thing that we hope for or the thing that we don't see.
The history of the translation of that verse is quite interesting in that, but before the Protestant Reformation, that verse was translated in such a way that Jack is suggesting here, where what the author is doing is describing something that is objective. Faith as an object is basically evidence that God is at work and creating doing something in you whereby you become an authentic believer, if I can put it that way. Then, as a result of Philip Melanchthon, who was Luther's sidekick, Melanchthon wanted to make something subjective out of it, and Luther tried to discourage him from doing so, and Luther was able to dissuade him from doing that until Luther died. And then Melanchthon started promoting his perspective on that verse, which is the subjective perspective, which we have in our English translations now, which is that that's actually what the author is doing, is defining faith for us. It's something that I have this assurance, I have this conviction. That's what faith is. But it's all a result, really, of Philip Melanchthon and his promoting his subjective interpretation of that verse. And then the English translators have simply followed suit since the Protestant Reformation.
Yeah, it's a very tragic mistranslation. I think it misses the whole point of the chapter to translate it that way. The definition of faith comes later, where he says, the one who has faith must believe that God is, and he's a rewarder of those who seek him. That's how you define faith, I think. Notice the interplay between the view of faith that you're struggling with, that you're talking about, and this notion of certainty. What happens is, because we think my belief in God has to have this luminescent certainty about it, we recognize that reason can't get me there, because reason always leaves room for doubt. It can't reach this luminescent certainty, so faith must be something else, and it can achieve luminescent certainty, right? This really shining certainty that I can have. Well, in our experience, what's the only thing that we can muster that brings about that kind of certainty? Dogmatism. And so what's happened over the course of time is we've turned faith into dogmatism. I don't have any reasons for believing this, but it's to my credit that I believe it anyway, and there's no doubt in my mind that it's true. Well, there's nothing rational about that. I mean, that we all recognize in every other area of life, that's completely irresponsible to do that. Dogmatism is a very irresponsible use of the human mind. But in the Christian culture, we've tended to turn that into a virtue by calling it faith.